within sight of Harvard Yard. The church was packed. Family, friends, colleagues, former students. In her 2 short years, Liz had been much loved. I took a pew in back, wanting to be invisible. I knew many, recognized others, felt the weight of all. Among the mourners was a man whom, beneath his puffy alcoholic's face, I knew to be Alcott Spence. Our eyes met briefly as we followed Liz's casket outside, though I do not think he remembered who I was. After the burial, the inner circle repaired to the Speed Club for a catered lunch. I had told Jonas that I needed to return early and couldn't make it, but he insisted so ardently that I had little choice. There were toasts, remembrances, a great deal of drinking. Every second was torture. As people were leaving, Jonas pulled me aside. "Let's go out to the garden. There's something I need to talk to you about." So here it was, I thought. The whole mess was about to come out. We exited through the library and sat on the steps that led down to the courtyard. The day was unusually warm, a mocking foretaste of spring. A spring I believed I would not see. Surely I would be living in a cell by then. He reached into the inside pocket of his jacket and removed a flask. He took a long pull and passed it to me. "Old times," he said. I didn't know how to respond. The conversation was his to steer. "You don't have to say it. I know I fucked up. I should have been there. That may be the worst thing." I'm sure she understood. How could she? He drank again and wiped his mouth. "The truth is, I think she was leaving me. Probably I deserved it." I felt my stomach drop. On the other hand, if he'd known it was me, he would have already said so. "Don't be ridiculous. She was probably just going to see her mother." He gave a fatalistic shrug. "Yeah, well, last time I checked, you don't need a passport to go to Connecticut." I had failed to consider this. There was nothing to say. "That's not the reason I asked you out here, though," he went on. "I'm sure you've heard the stories about me." "A little. Everybody thinks I'm a big joke." "Well, they're wrong." "Maybe this isn't the day for this, Jonas." "Actually, it's the perfect day. I'm close, Tim. Very, very close. There's a site in Bolivia. A temple, at least 1,000 years old. The legends say there's a grave there, the body of a man infected with the virus I've been searching for. It's nothing new. There are lots of stories like that. Too many for all this to be nothing, in my opinion. But that's another argument. The thing is, I've got hard evidence now. A friend at the CDC came to me a few months back. He'd heard about my work, and he'd happened across something he thought would interest me. 5 years ago, a group of 4 American tourists showed up at a hospital in La Paz. All of them had what looked like hantavirus. They'd been on some kind of eco-tour in the jungle. But here's the thing. They all had terminal cancer. The tour was one of those last wish things. You know, do the stuff you always wanted to do before you check out." I had no idea where he was headed. "And here's where it gets interesting. All of them recovered, and not just from the Hanta. From the cancer. Stage 4 ovarian, inoperable glioblastoma, leukemia with full lymphatic involvement. Not a trace of it was left. And they weren't just cured. They were better than cured. It was as if the aging process had been reversed. The youngest one was 56, the oldest 70. They looked like 20-year-olds. That's quite a story. Are you kidding? It's the story. If this pans out, it will be the most important medical discovery in history. I was still skeptical. So why haven't I heard about it? It isn't in any of the literature. Good question. My friend at the CDC suspects the military got involved. The whole thing went over to USAMRID. Why would they want it? Who knows? Maybe they just want the credit. Though that's the optimistic view. One day you have Einstein puzzling over the theory of relativity. The next, you've got the Manhattan Project and a big hole in the ground. It's not like it hasn't happened before. He had a point. Have you examined them? The four patients. Jonas took another pull of the whiskey. Well, that's a bit of a wrinkle. They're all dead. But I thought you said, oh, it wasn't the cancer. They all seemed to kind of, well, speed up. Like their bodies couldn't handle it. Somebody took a video. They were practically bouncing off the walls. The longest any of them lasted was 86 days. That's a mighty big wrinkle. He gave me a hard look. Think about it, Tim. Something's out there. I couldn't find it in time to save Liz, and that'll haunt me the rest of my days. But I can't stop now. Not just in spite of her, because of her. 155,000 human beings die every day. How long have we been sitting here? 10 minutes? That's over 1,000 people just like Liz. People with lives. Families who love them. I need you, Tim. And not just because you're my oldest friend and the smartest guy I know. I'll be honest. I'm having a hard time with the money. Nobody wants to back this anymore. Maybe your credibility could, you know, grease the gears a bit. My credibility. If he only knew how little that was worth. I don't know, Jonas. If you can't do it for me, do it for Liz. I'll admit, the scientist in me was intrigued. It was also true that I wanted nothing to do with this project, or with Jonas ever again. In the slender 10 minutes in which 1,000 human beings had perished, I had come very profoundly to despise him. Perhaps I always had. I despised his obliviousness, his monstrous ego, his self-aggrandizing pomp. I despised his naked manipulation of my loyalties and his unwavering faith that the answer to everything lay within his grasp. I despised the fact that he didn't know one goddamn thing about anything at all, but most of all, I despised him. For letting Liz die alone. Can I give it some thought? An easy dodge. I had no such intentions. He began to say something, then stopped himself. Got it. You have your reputation to consider. Believe me, I know how it goes. It's not that. It's just a big commitment. I have a lot on my plate these days. I'm not going to let you off easy, you know. I was pretty sure you wouldn't. We were silent for a time. Jonas was looking at the garden, though I knew he wasn't seeing it. It's funny. I always knew this day would come. Now, I can't believe it. It's like it's not even happening, you know? I feel like I'll go back to the house and there she'll be. Grading papers at her desk or stirring something in the kitchen. He blew out a breath and looked at me. I should have been a better friend to you all these years. I shouldn't have let so much time pass. Forget it, I said. It was my fault, too. The conversation ended there. "Well," Jonas said, "thank you for being here, Tim. I know you'd come anyway, just for her. But it means a lot to me. Let me know what you decide." I sat a while after he'd gone. The building was quiet. The mourners had left, returning to their lives. How lucky they were, I thought. I heard nothing more from Jonas. Winter yielded to spring, then summer, and I began to believe that the dots hadn't been connected after all, and I would remain a free man. Bit by bit, the girl's death ceased to hang over my every thought and action. It was still there, of course. The memory touched down often and without warning, paralyzing me with guilt so deep I could hardly draw a breath. But the mind is nimble. It seeks to preserve itself. One particularly clement summer day, cool and dry, with a sky so crisp it looked like a great blue dome snapped down over the city, I was walking to the subway from my office when I realized that for a full 10 minutes, I hadn't felt utterly ruined. Perhaps life could go on after all. I returned to teaching in the fall. A bevy of new graduate assistants awaited me, as if the administration took delight in torturing me. Most were female. But to say that those days were over for me would be the understatement of the century. Mine was a monk's existence, as it would be henceforth. I did my work, I taught my classes, I sought the company of no one, man or woman. I heard secondhand that Jonas had found funding for his expedition after all and was gearing up for Bolivia. Good riddance, I thought. On a day in late January, I was grading labs in my office when there was a knock on the door. "Come." 2 people, a man and a woman. I instantly knew who and what they were. My face probably betrayed my guilt in a heartbeat. "Got a minute, Professor Fanning?" the woman said. "I'm Detective Reynaldo. This is Detective Phelps. We'd like to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind." "Of course." I feigned surprised. "Sit down, detectives." "We'll stand, if that's all right." The conversation lasted barely 15 minutes, but it was enough to let me know that the noose was tightening. A woman had come forward, the babysitter. She was an illegal, which explained the long delay. Though she had glimpsed me quickly, the description she provided matched the bartender's. He did not recall my name, but had overheard the part of our conversation in which she confessed her crush on me, using the phrase, "a lot of the girls did." This led them to Nicole's college transcript, and eventually to me, who bore a remarkable resemblance to the sitter's description of the suspect. A very remarkable resemblance. I made the customary denials. No, I had never been to the bar in question. No, I did not recall the girl from my classes. I had seen the story in the papers, but had made no connection. No, I could not recall my whereabouts that night. When, exactly? Probably I was in bed. Interesting. In bed, you say? Perhaps I was reading. I'm a bit of an insomniac. I really don't recall. That's strange, because according to the TSA, you were scheduled to be on a flight to Athens. Any thoughts on that you'd care to share at this point, Dr. Fanning? The cold sweat of the criminal dampened my palms. Of course they would know this. How could I have been so dumb? Very well, I said, doing my best to seem annoyed. I wish this hadn't had to come out, but since you insist on prying into my personal life, I was going away with a friend. A married friend. A single eyebrow lasciviously lifted. care to tell us her name? My mind was racing. Could they connect us? I'd paid for the tickets in cash and bought them separately to cover our tracks. Our seats weren't even next to each other's. I'd planned to sort it out before we boarded. I'm sorry, I can't do that. It's not my place. A gentleman doesn't kiss and tell, huh? Something like that. Detective Rinaldo smiled imperiously, enjoying herself. A gentleman who runs off with another man's wife. Doubt you'll win any prizes for that. I don't claim to, detective. So why didn't you go? I gave my most innocent shrug. She changed her mind. Her husband is a colleague of mine. It was a stupid idea to begin with. That's really all there is to it. For 10 full seconds, neither of us spoke, a gap I was obviously meant to fill, incriminating myself. Well, that's all for now, Dr. Fanning. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day. She gave me her card. You think of anything else, you call me, all right? I'll do that, detective. And I do mean anything. I waited 30 minutes to make sure they were well clear of the building, then took the subway home. How long did I have? Days? Hours? How much paperwork did they need to get me into a lineup? I could think of only one option. I called Jonas's office, then his cell, but got no answer. I would have to risk an email. Jonas, I've given some thought to your proposal. Sorry it took me so long. Not sure how much I can offer at this late date, but I'd like to sign on. When do you leave? T.F. I waited at my computer, hitting the refresh button over and over. 30 minutes later, his reply came. Delighted. We leave in 3 days. Have already cleared your visa with state. Don't ever say I'm not a man with connections. How many more do you need for your team? Knowing you, you'll bring a flotilla of attractive female grad assistants, which we could sure use to brighten up the place. Move your ass, buddy. We're going to change the world. J.L. 23. There is not much more to say. I went. I was infected. Of those infected, I alone survived. And thus was built a race to establish dominion over the earth. There was a night when Jonas came to see me in my chamber. This was long after my transformation, by which time I had adjusted to my circumstances. I could not know what the hour was, such things having lost all meaning in my captive state. My plans were well underway. I and my co-conspirators had identified the avenue of our escape. The weak-minded men who watched over us. Day by day we had infiltrated their thoughts, filling their minds with our black dreams, bringing them into the fold. Their flabby souls were collapsing. Soon, they would be ours. His voice came over the speaker. Tim, it's Jonas. This was not his first visit. Many was the time I had seen his face behind the glass. Yet he had not addressed me directly since the day of my awakening. The last years had wrought startling changes to his appearance. Long-haired, wild-bearded, crazed-eyed, he had become the very image of the mad scientist I had always thought him to be. I know you can't talk. Hell, I'm not even sure you can understand me. I felt a confession coming. I was, I admit, only vaguely interested in what he had to say. His disturbed conscience. What did I care? His visit had also interrupted my feeding schedule. Though in life I had not much cared for the taste of wild game, I had come to enjoy raw rabbit very much. Something bad is happening. I'm really losing control of this thing. Indeed, I thought. God, I miss her, Tim. I should have listened to her. I should have listened to you. If only you could talk to me. You will hear from me soon enough, I thought. I've got one more chance, Tim. I still believe this can work. Maybe if I pull it off, I can get the military to back away. I can still turn everything around. Hope springs eternal, does it not? The thing is, it has to be a child. He was silent for a moment. I can't believe I'm saying this. They just brought her in. I don't even want to know what they did to get her here. Jesus, Tim. She's just a little kid. A child, I thought. Here was an intriguing wrinkle. No wonder Jonas despised himself. I delighted in his misery. I had learned how low a man could sink. Why shouldn't he? They're calling her Amy NLN. No last name. They got her from some orphanage. God almighty, she doesn't even have a proper name. She's just some girl from nowhere. I felt my heart go out to this unlucky child, plucked from her life to become the last pitiable hope of a crazy man. Yet even as I considered this, a new thought was bearing fruit inside me. A little girl, bathed in the innocence of youth. Of course. The symmetry was undeniable. It was a message meant for me. To face her, that would be the test. I heard the rumble of distant armies joining. This girl from nowhere, this Amy NLN. Who was Alpha? Who Omega? Who the beginning and who the end? Did you love her, Tim? You can tell me. Yes, I thought. Yes. And yes, and yes. She was the only thing that ever mattered. I loved her more than any man could. I loved her enough to watch her die. The police came to me, you see. They knew the two of you were supposed to be on the same plane. You know what's funny? I was actually happy for her. She deserved someone who could love her the way she needed, the way I never could. I guess what I'm saying is, I'm glad it was you. Was it possible? Had my eyes, the eyes of a beast, a demon, begun to shed tears? Well, Jonas cleared his throat. I guess that's what I came to say. I'm sorry about all this, Tim. I hope you know that. You were the best friend I ever had. Now it is dark. Stars soar above the vacant city, heaven's diadem. A century since the last person walked here. And still one cannot travel its streets, as I do, without seeing one's face reflected a thousandfold. Shop windows, bodegas and brownstones, the mirrored flanks of skyscrapers, great vertical tombs of glass. I look, and what do I see? Man? Monster? Devil? a freak of cold nature, or heaven's cruel utensil? The first is intolerable to think, the second no less so. Who is the monster now? I walk, listen closely, and one still hears the footfalls of a throng engraved in stone. At the center has grown a forest in New York, a great green eruption, alive with animal sounds and smells. There are rats everywhere, of course. They grow to fantastic dimensions. Once I saw one that I thought might be a dog, or a wild pig, or something brand new to the world. The pigeons wheel, the rain falls, the seasons turn without us. In winter, all is dressed with snow. City of memories, city of mirrors. Am I alone? Yes and no. I am a man of many descendants. They lie hidden away. Some are here, those who once called this island home. They slumber beneath the streets of the forgotten metropolis. Others lie elsewhere, my ambassadors, awaiting final use. In slumber, they become themselves again. In dreams, they relive their human lives. Which world is the real one? Only when they're aroused does the hunger obliterate them, taking them over, their souls spilling into mine. And so I leave them as they are. It is the only mercy I can offer. Oh, my brother. 12 in sum, you were sorely used by this world. I spoke to you like the god you thought I was, though in the end I could not save you. I would not say I failed to see this coming. From the start your fates were written. You could not help being what you were, which was the truth of us. Consider the species known as man. We lie, we cheat, we want what others have and take it. We make war upon each other and the earth. We harvest lives in multitudes. We have mortgaged the planet and spent the cash on trifles. We may have loved, but never well enough. We never truly knew ourselves. We forgot the world. Now it has forgotten us. How many years will pass before jealous nature reclaims this place, before it is as if we never existed at all? Buildings will crumble. Skyscrapers will come crashing to the ground. Trees will sprout and spread their canopies. The oceans will rise, rinsing the rest away. It is said that one day all will be water again. A vast ocean will blanket the world. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. How will God, if there is a God, remember us? Will he even know our names? All stories end when they have returned to their beginnings. What can we do but remember in his stead? I go abroad, into the streets of the empty city, always returning. I take my place upon the steps, beneath the inverted heavens, I watch the clock. Its mournful faces stay the same. Time frozen at the moment of man's departure. The last train exiting the station. 3. The Sun. Texas Republic. Population 204,876. March 122 AV. 21 years after the discovery of the Bergensfjord. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Shakespeare, As You Like It. 24. Peter Jackson, age 51, president of the Texas Republic, stood at the Kerrville gate in the pale dawn light, waiting to say goodbye to his son. Sarah and Hollis had just arrived. Kate was working at the hospital, but had promised that her husband Bill would bring the girls. Caleb was loading the last of their gear into the wagon, while Pim, in a loose cotton dress, stood nearby, holding baby Theo. Two strong horses, fit for plowing, idled in their harnesses. "I guess that's it," Caleb said as he finished lashing the final crate. He was wearing a long-sleeved work shirt and overalls. He'd let his hair grow long. He checked the load on his rifle, a lever-action 30-06, and put it up on the seat. "We really should get moving if we're going to make Hunt by dark." They were headed to one of the outer settlements, a 2-day ride on the buckboard. The land had only just been incorporated, though people had been homesteading there for years. Caleb had spent most of 2 years preparing the place, framing the house, digging the well, laying out fences, before returning for Pim and the baby. Good soil, the clear water of the river, woods heavy with game. There were worse places, Peter thought, to start a life. "You can't go yet," Sarah said. "The girls will be heartbroken if you leave without seeing them." Sarah had simultaneously signed these words for Pim, who now turned to her husband with a stern look. "You know how Bill is," Caleb signed. "We could be here all day." "No, we wait." There was no point in arguing when Pim had made up her mind. Caleb always said it was the woman's stubbornness that had kept them together while he was stationed with the army on the oil road, and Peter didn't doubt it. The two of them had married the day after Caleb had finally capitulated and resigned his commission. Not, as he often pointed out, that there was much of an army remaining to resign from. Like nearly everything else in Kerrville, the army had scattered to the winds. Barely anyone remembered the expeditionary, disbanded 20 years ago, when the Texas Code had been suspended. It had been one of the great disappointments of Caleb's life that there was nobody left to fight anymore. He'd spent his years in the service as a glorified ditch digger, assigned to the construction of the telegraph line between Kerrville and Burney. It was a different world than the one Peter had known. The city walls went unmanned. The perimeter lights had gone out one by one and never been repaired. The gate hadn't been shut in a decade. A whole generation had grown to adulthood, thinking the virals were little more than exaggerated boogeymen in scary stories told by their elders, who, in the fashion of all old people since the dawn of time, believed theirs had been the vastly harder and more consequential life. But it was like Kate's husband Bill to be late. The man had his positive qualities. He was far more easygoing than Kate, counterbalancing her often humorless maturity, and there was no question that he adored their daughters. But he was scattered and disorganized, liked the lick and cards, and lacked anything approximating a work ethic. Peter had tried to bring him into the administration as a favor to Sarah and Hollis, offering him a low-level job with the Bureau of Taxation that required little more than the ability to use a stamp. But as with Bill's brief forays into carpentry, farriering, and driving a transport, it wasn't long before he drifted away. Mostly, he seemed content to look after his daughters, make Kate the occasional meal, and sneak out to the tables at night. Both winning and losing, but, according to Kate, always winning just a little more. Baby Theo had begun to fuss. Caleb used the delay to pick the horse's hooves while Sarah took Thea from Pim to change his diaper. Just when it had begun to seem that Bill wouldn't show, Kate appeared with the girls, Bill bringing up the rear with a sheepish look on his face. "How did you get away?" Sarah asked her daughter. "Don't worry, Madam Director. Jenny's got it covered. Plus, you love me too much to fire me." "You know, I really hate it when you call me that." Elle and her younger sister Mary, who everybody called Bug, dashed to Pim, who knelt and hugged them together. The girls' signing abilities were limited to simple phrases, and all exchanged "I love you," circling their hearts with a flat palm. "Visit me," Pim signed, then glanced up at Kate, who explained what she was asking.
"Can we?"
Bug asked eagerly.
"When?"
"We'll see," Kate said. "Maybe after the baby is born." This was a sore subject. Sarah had wanted Pim to delay their departure until after the birth of their second child. But that wouldn't be until nearly the end of the summer, far too late to plant. Nor did Pim, in her obstinate way, plan to return alone for the birth. "I've done it before," she said. "How hard can it be?"
"Please, Mom," Elle begged.
"I said we'll see." Hugs all around. Peter glanced at Sarah. She was feeling it too. Their children were leaving for good. It was what you were supposed to want, the thing you worked for. Yet facing it was a different matter. Caleb shook Peter's hand, then pulled him into a masculine embrace. "So I guess this is it. Mind if I say some stupid things, like I love you? You're still a terrible chess player, though. I promise to practice. Who knows? Maybe you'll find me out there before too long." Caleb grinned. "See? That's what I've been telling you. No more politics. It's time to find a nice girl and settle down." "If you only knew," Peter thought. "Every night I close my eyes and do just that." He lowered his voice slightly. "Did you do like I asked?" Caleb sighed indulgently. "Humor your old man." "Yeah, yeah, I dug it." "And you used the steel framing I sent out. It's important." "I did it just like you said, I promise. At least I've got someplace to sleep when Pim kicks me out." Peter looked up at his daughter-in-law, who had climbed onto the bench. Baby Theo, worn out by all the attention, had passed out in her arms. "Look after him for me," Peter signed.
"I will."
"The babies, too." She smiled at him.
"The babies, too."
Caleb lifted himself onto the buckboard. "Be safe," Peter said. "Good luck." The indelible moment of departure. Everyone stepped back as the wagon moved through the gate. Bill and the girls were the first to leave, followed by Kate and Hollis. Peter had a full schedule ahead of him, but he couldn't quite bring himself to start his day. Nor, apparently, could Sarah. They stood together without speaking, watching the wagon bearing their children away. "Why do I feel sometimes like they're parenting us?" Sarah said. "They will be soon enough." Sarah snorted. "Now there's something to look forward to." The wagon was still in sight. It was crossing the old fence line to the orange zone. Beyond it, only a fraction of the fields had been plowed for planting. There simply wasn't enough manpower, nor were there that many mouths remaining to feed. The population of Kerrville itself had shrunk to just about 5,000. Make that 4,997, thought Peter. "Bill's a mess," Peter said. Sarah sighed. "And yet, Kate loves him. What's a mother to do?" "I could try again with a job." "I'm afraid he's a lost cause." She glanced at him. "Speaking of which, what's this about you not running for re-election?"
"Where did you hear that?"
She shrugged coyly.
"Oh, just around the halls."
"Meaning Chase."
"Who else? The man is chomping at the bit."
"So? Is it true?"
"I haven't decided." Maybe 10 years is enough, though.
People will miss you.
I doubt they'll even notice. Peter thought she might ask him about Michael. What had he heard? Was her brother okay, at least? They avoided the details, a painful reality. Michael on the trade, rumors of some crazy project, Greer in cahoots with Dunk, an armed compound on the ship channel with trucks full of lick and God knew what else leaving every day. But she didn't. Instead, Sarah asked, "What does Vicky think?" The question pierced him with guilt. He'd been meaning to visit the woman for weeks, months even. "I need to go see her," he said. "How is she doing?" The two of them were still standing shoulder to shoulder as their eyes traced the course of the wagon. It was little more than a speck now. It crested a small rise, began to sink, then was gone. Sarah turned toward him. "I wouldn't wait," she said. His day dissolved into the customary duties, a meeting with the collector of taxes to decide what to do about homesteaders who refused to pay, a new judicial appointment to make, an agenda to set for the upcoming meeting of the territorial legislature, various papers to sign, which Chase placed in front of him with only cursory description. At 3 o'clock, Apgar appeared in Peter's door. Did the president have a minute? Everybody else on the staff simply called him by his first name, as he preferred. But Gunner, a stickler for protocol, refused. Always he was Mr. President. The subject was guns, specifically a lack of them. The Army had always run on a combination of reconditioned civilian and military weaponry. A lot had come from Fort Hood. Plus, the old Texas had been a well-armed place. Virtually every house, it seemed, had a gun cabinet in it, and there were weapon manufacturing facilities throughout the state, offering a bountiful supply of parts for repair and reloading. But a lot of time had passed, and certain guns lasted longer than others. Metal-framed pistols, like the old Browning 1911, Sig Sauer semi-autos, and Army-issue Beretta M9s, were close to indestructible with adequate maintenance. So were most revolvers, shotguns, and bolt-action rifles. But polymer-framed pistols, like Glocks, as well as M4 and AR-15 rifles, the bread and butter of the military, did not enjoy the same indefinite shelf life. As their plastic casings cracked with fatigue, more and more were retired. Others had leaked via the trade into civilian hands. Some had simply vanished. But that was only part of the problem. The more pressing issue was a dwindling supply of ammunition. Decades had passed since a pre-war cartridge had been fired, except for the stockpiles in Tifty's bunker, which were vacuum-sealed. The primer and cordite didn't last more than 20 years. All of the Army's rounds had been either reloaded from spent brass or manufactured with empty casings taken from 2 munitions plants, one near Waco and a second in Victoria. Casting lead for bullets was easy. Far trickier was engineering a propellant. Weapons-grade cordite required a complicated cocktail of highly volatile chemicals, including large quantities of nitroglycerin. It could be done, but it wasn't easy, and it necessitated both manpower and expertise, both of which were in very short supply. The Army was down to just a couple thousand soldiers, 1,500 spread throughout the townships, and a garrison of 500 in Kerrville. They had no chemists at all. "I think we both know what we're talking about here," Peter said. Apgar, seated across the paper-stacked expanse of Peter's desk, was looking at his nails. "I didn't say I liked it, but the trade has the manufacturing capacity, and it's not like we haven't dealt with them before. Dunk's not Tifty." "What about Michael?" Peter frowned. "Sore subject. The guy was an OFC. He knows how to cook oil. He can do this." "What about this boat of his?" Peter asked. "He's your friend. You tell me what it's all about." Peter took a long breath.
I wish I could. I haven't seen the guy in over 20 years.
On top of which, we tell the trade we're out of ammo, we've tipped our hand. Dunk will be sitting in this chair in a weekend.
So threaten him. He comes through for us or that's it. The deal's off. We storm the isthmus and put him out of business.
Across that causeway? It'd be a bloodbath. He'll smell a bluff before I stop talking.
Peter leaned back in his chair. He imagined himself laying out Apgar's terms to Dunk. What could the man do but laugh in his face?
This is all stick. There's no way it's going to work.
What can we offer him?
Gunner scowled.
What, besides money, guns, and whores?
Last time I checked, Dunk had all of those in plentiful supply. Plus, the guy's practically a folk hero.
You know what happened last Sunday?
Out of the blue, a 5-ton full of women shows up at the encampment in Bandera where they're housing the road crews. The driver has a note. Compliments of your good friend Dunk Withers. On a fucking Sunday.
Did they send them away?
Gunner snorted through his nose.
No, they took them to church. What do you think?
Well, there has to be something.
You could ask him yourself.
A joke, but not entirely. There was also Michael to consider. Despite everything, Peter liked to think that the man would at least agree to talk to him.
Maybe I'll do that.
As Gunner rose, Chase appeared in the doorway.
What is it, Fort? Peter asked.
We've got another sinkhole, a big one. 2 houses this time.
This had been happening all spring. A rumbling in the earth. Then, within moments, the ground would collapse. The largest hole had been over 50 feet wide.
This place really is falling apart, Peter thought.
Anybody hurt? He asked.
Not this time. Both houses were empty.
Well, that's lucky.
Ford was still looking at him expectantly.
Is there something else?
I'm thinking we should make a statement. People are going to want to know what you're doing about it.
Such as what?
Telling the ground to behave itself?
When Ford said nothing, Peter sighed.
Fine, write something up and I'll sign it. Engineering on the case, situation in hand, etc.
He raised an eyebrow at Ford.
Okay?
Apgar looked like he was about to laugh.
Jesus, Peter thought. It never ends.
He got to his feet.
Come on, Gunner. Let's get some air.
He had become president not because he desired the job particularly, but as a favor to Vicky. Right after her election to a 3rd term, she had developed a tremor in her right hand. This was followed by a series of accidents, including a fall on the Capitol steps that had broken her ankle. Her handwriting, always precise, decayed to a scrawl. Her speech adopted a weirdly monotonic quality, lacking all inflection. The tremors spread to her other hand, and she began to make involuntary rocking motions with her neck. Peter and Chase had managed to hide the situation by keeping her public schedule to a minimum, but halfway into her 2nd year, it became clear that she could no longer continue. The Texas Constitution, which had superseded the Code of Modified Martial Law, allowed her to name a president pro tem. At the time, Peter was serving as Secretary of Territorial Affairs, a position he had taken on midway through her 2nd term. It was one of the most visible jobs in the cabinet, and Vicky made no secret of the fact that she was grooming him for something more. Still, he had assumed that Chase would be the one to step in. The man had been with her for years. When Vicky called Peter to her office, he wholly expected a meeting to discuss the transition to Chase's administration. What he found was a judge with a Bible. 2 minutes later, he was president of the Texas Republic. This was, he came to understand, what the woman had intended from the start, to create her successor from the ground up. Peter had stood for election 2 years later, won easily, and ran unopposed for his 2nd term. Some of this was his personal popularity as a chief executive. As Vicky had predicted, his stock was very high. But it was also true that he had assumed the office at a time when it was easy to make people happy. Kerrville itself was on its way to becoming irrelevant. How long before it was just one more provincial town? The farther out people settled, the less the idea of centralized authority held sway. The legislature had relocated to Burnie and almost never met. Financial capital had followed human capital to the townships. People were opening businesses, trading commodities at market-established prices, negotiating life on their own terms. In Fredericksburg, a group of private investors had pooled their money to open a bank, the first of its kind. There were still problems, and only the federal administration possessed the resources for major infrastructure projects, roads, dams, telegraph lines. But even this wouldn't last indefinitely. When Peter was being honest with himself, he understood that he was not so much running the place as guiding it into port. Let Chase have his chance, he thought. 2 decades in public life, with its endless closed-door bickering, was plenty for any man. Peter had never farmed. He'd never so much as planted a tomato. But he could learn. And best of all, a plow had no opinions. Vicky had retired to a small wood-frame house on the east side of town. A lot of the neighborhood was empty, folks having cleared out long ago. It was getting dark when he stepped onto the porch. A single light was burning in the front parlor. He heard footsteps. Then the door opened to reveal Meredith, Vicky's partner, wiping her hands on a cloth. Peter. About 60, she was a petite woman with sharp blue eyes. She and Vicky had been together for years. I didn't know you were coming. I'm sorry, I should have sent word. No, come in, of course. She stepped back. She's awake. I was just about to feed her some supper. I know she'll be happy to see you. Vicky's bed was in the parlor. As Peter entered, she glanced in his direction, her head jerking side to side against the elevated pillows.
Mr. President.
It was as if she were swallowing the words, then spitting them out again. He drew a chair to the side of her bed. How are you feeling?
Today, not so bad.
I'm sorry I've been away. Her hands were moving about restlessly on the blanket. She gave a crooked smile.
That's okay. As you can see, I've been busy.
Meredith appeared in the door with a tray, which she placed on the bedside table. On the tray were a bowl of clear broth and a glass of water with a straw. She cupped the back of Vicky's head to lift it forward from the pillow and tied a cotton bib around her neck. Night had fallen, making mirrors of the windows. Do you want me to do it? Peter asked Meredith.
Vicky, do you want Peter to help you with dinner?
Why not?
Small sips, Meredith told him, and patted him on the arm. She gave him the faintest of smiles. Her face was heavy with fatigue. The woman probably hadn't slept a solid night in months and was simply grateful for the help. If you need me, I'll be in the kitchen. Peter began with the water, holding the straw to Vicky's lips, which were flaked with dryness, then moved on to the broth. He could see the tremendous effort it required for her to swallow even the tiniest amount. Most of it dribbled from the corners of her mouth. He used the bib to wipe her chin.
Funny.
What's that?
You feeding me like a baby.
He gave her more of the broth. The least I could do. You spoon-fed me more than once. Her neck made a sinewy pumping motion as she tried to swallow. It exhausted him just watching it.
How's the campaign?
Not really gotten started yet. Been a bit tied up.
You're full of shit.
She had him dead to rights. But of course she always did. He fed her another spoonful, without much luck. Caleb and Pim left for the townships today.
You're just blue. It will pass.
What? You don't think I can farm?
I know you, Peter. You'll go crazy.
She said nothing else. Peter put the bowl aside. She'd consumed only a fraction. When he looked up again, Vicky's eyes were closed. He doused the lamp and watched her. Only in sleep did the restless turmoil of her body cease. A few minutes passed. He heard a sound behind him and saw Meredith standing in the kitchen doorway. "It happens like that," the woman said quietly. "One minute she's there. The next..." She left the thought unfinished. "Is there anything I can do?" Meredith placed one hand on his arm and met his eye. She was so proud of you, Peter. It made her so happy, watching all you've done. "Will you call me if you need me? Anything at all?"
"I think this was a perfect visit, don't you? Let's let it be the last one."
He returned to Vicky's bedside and lifted one of her hands from the blanket. The woman didn't stir. He held it for a minute, thinking about her, then leaned down and kissed her on the cheek, something he had never done before. "Thank you," he whispered. He followed Meredith to the porch. "She loved you, you know," the woman said. It wasn't the kind of thing she said very often, not even to me. That's just how she was. But she did. "I loved her, too." "She knows you did." They embraced. "Goodbye, Peter." The street was silent, no lights burning. He touched a finger to his eye. It came away wet. Well, he was the president. He could cry if he wanted to. His son was gone. Others would follow. He had entered the era of his life when things would drop away. Peter tipped his face to the sky. It was true what they said about the stars. The more you looked, the more you saw. They were a comfort, their watchful presence a force of reassurance. Yet this had not always been so. He stood and looked at them, remembering a time when the sight of so many stars had meant something else entirely. 25. They spent the night in Hunt, sleeping on the ground by the wagon, and arrived in Mystic Township on the second afternoon. The town was a threadbare outpost, a small main street with just a few houses, a general store, and a government building that acted as everything from the post office to the jail. They passed through and followed the river road west through a tunnel of thickening foliage. Pim had never been to the townships before. Everything she saw seemed to fascinate her. "Look at the trees," she signed to the baby. "Look at the river. Look at the world." The day had begun to fade when they reached the homestead. The house stood on a rise looking down toward the Guadalupe, with a paddock for the horses, fields of black soil between, and a privy in the rear. Caleb stepped down from the buckboard and reached up for Theo, who was sleeping in a basket. "What do you think?" Since Theo's birth,
Caleb had made it his habit to speak and sign simultaneously.